I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Hard to believe it, but next week some area students head back to school. We also have college students making their way to their college campuses. That got us to thinking about transitions. Psychologist Michael Abruzzese and psychiatrist Mark Whaley are here today to talk about the psychology of transitions. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mindy.
Of course, from everything from the first day of kindergarten, heading off to college, becoming a parent, an empty nester, our lives are just full of transitions.
That's right.
But let's begin with transitional objects. We think of them as being associated with young children, but about 25% of young women going off to college take along something identifiable as a childhood transitional object. So what is a transitional object?
Well, it's a object, non-living a piece of material that a infant primarily gets attached to as a soother and a comforter. And it has to be something that the infant itself or the child itself chooses. You can't just legislate it and give it a teddy bear and expect that to be the attached to object. But it helps with separation is the psychological understanding of it. And this was promulgated initially in the early 1950s by a psychoanalyst, Dr. Winnicott, who was also a pediatrician. And he talked about the use of transitional objects as a help in separation, which is the primary psychological goal, really, of life, if you want to say, if you want to take a long view of it, but really of infancy and early childhood. When the child is born, it is psychologically at least merged with the mother. And you can say that life is really a series of going through transitions to separate. Transitional objects are imbued by the infant with the comfort that the mother gives, so that it's not the mother, but it still can produce the same reminiscences mm-hmm. of the mother. And the early brain is equipped to do that, at least. So it's a self-soother. Mm-hmm. Very, very important for psychological development, and more common than not, certainly with kids. Not all kids have it, but I think most kids do.
Oh.
Well, transitional objects, as Mark talked about, began in the old psychoanalytical theory. Otto Rank was also involved in that, in his object relations theory. Very, very interesting, fascinating stuff. But I would part company with just the limitations of that. People have transitional objects their entire lives. Mm-hmm. People who are somewhat more psychologically developed tend to have internalized transitional objects. So that may have serious repercussions in terms of what we like because of things that remind us of something else. So, for example, if I meet someone and that person looks familiar, you know, that could be an association with something that reminded me of something positive and negative before, similar to what a transitional object would be. We know in behavioral psychology, because of reinforcement, that we can inadvertently get a transitional object to mean something to us and carry it along with us that we don't really want to. Hmm. It's kind of a negative kind of thing. Though originally the psychoanalysts were talking about the positive aspect of helping us cope. The same kind of mechanism that permits us to deliberately have something that's self-soothing can also permit us to carry along something with us that is kind of rankling or an irritant to us. Mm-hmm. And we can think of a transitional object colloquially as being when you see a movie, you don't always have the movie star be in every scene. Sometimes you have stand-ins for them. Well, you can't tell it's a stand-in because it's from their back or the side or something like that. And so that's what a transitional object is. So transitions are hugely important in our lives. Life is a series of transitions, and we don't realize how important they are to us, but they're extremely important.
Yeah, that's right.
And I guess for many children, the first big transition is that first day of school, kindergarten or preschool. And that's a big one. And that's not only, can be a big transition for the little kid. It's also for mom or dad.
True, true. It's very difficult because you are changing the entire family structure. And we'll talk about this more as we talk about going on to college, but you are changing the family structure, and most people don't have any support or experience in how to deal with the change in the family structure. And certainly with a little child, the parent's just getting used to the new family structure. Mm-hmm. And you can go to a preschool as young as 2 3/4 years old, and some parents put their infants in daycare because they have to go to work.
Right.
You know, so sometimes that may interrupt with attachment and bonding that we've talked about earlier in a program.
Right.
So transitions and managing transitions and being aware of them is hugely important.
Yeah, and from a child's standpoint, he's leaving the world of individual care and attention to one of a more group care, more impersonal. That's a loss as well as a gain. But from the child's view, the anxiety about the transition has to do with the loss.
Yeah. And it can seem as well, what are you worried about? You know, so what's advice you give to parents as maybe their child's getting ready to go to kindergarten and the kid's a little nervous about it?
Parents have to monitor their own anxiety about the loss. And they have to, before they can do that, they have to be aware that such a thing exists, because most people just aren't aware of that. So it's important to be aware of any kind of stress or anxiety you as the caregiver, the mom or dad, a grandparent, might be experiencing. And then if that is too great, if you're too nervous about it or yourself, you can sort of communicate that to the child, and you can create that in the child. And that really is kind of the genesis of something we call separation anxiety. Separation anxiety really is generated by the caregiver. It doesn't come from the child. They don't invent it. It develops sometimes inadvertently, sometimes deliberately, by the caregiver. And though that might be cute and reinforcing to the caregiver when the child doesn't really want to separate too easily, eventually the caregiver realizes this is really very debilitating to me, having the child be so clingy. So we have to be aware of our own state and our own anxiety and sense of loss, or maybe a sense of foreboding about the child going. And then once we are aware of that, we can talk to the child and communicate with the child. And there are practical things that you could do, such as visit the daycare or the school ahead of time, try and meet the teacher ahead of time. And schools now do that throughout any kind of transition. Quite often they have, in Barnesville, they have ice cream socials, they have mm-hmm. get-togethers and things like that, to try and make what Mike and Bob called inoculation theory work. You sort of want to inoculate someone against the stress of a transition and help normalize it for them. So anything you could do to help normalize the child and not stigmatize them, not make them think that there's something wrong with them by being nervous about going to someplace new, but listen to them and try and make it as smooth and easy and normal a transition as possible, and pay attention to their concerns.
Yeah, this transition is a two-way street, is what you're saying, and mm-hmm. makes a whole lot of sense. And the parent does have a duty to assess their own psychological state about it, because it's contagious, and they can induce further anxiety in the child. But then the child becomes responsible, or feels responsible, for the parents being upset and lonely and being there in the, quote, empty nest or empty house. So you have to be careful. But in terms of what to do, in addition to the inoculation, once you take an inner look at your own state, I would advise to talk about the adventure involved and the newness and the opportunity involved in what's coming, because that's really what the transition is all about. And the more you can anticipate that side of it, what you gain as opposed to what you lose, that helps.
Yeah. Of course, I guess a big transition, at least thinking back to when my daughter was younger, that transition from elementary school to junior high, I think that was bigger transition maybe for me than it was for my mm-hmm. daughter, because, you know, oh my gosh, it's junior high. And right. This is where they get introduced to all kinds of things that you aren't monitoring anymore.
Right. That's the end of childhood and the beginning of adolescence. That's the point. The race starts.
Yeah. And I think it is for the kids too. When you think about it, they're like, oh my gosh, I'm going to junior high.
Well, I think it used to be like that, perhaps when we were in school, but nowadays we have all sorts of different building closures and openings, and some schools are being built and other schools are being consolidated, schools I've already been to before. So it really is a change in building, not so much the junior high. Now you have middle school, mm-hmm. then you have sometimes there's a transition, kindergarten, first, second, and third grade, and then you have fourth and fifth grade, and then you go on to a sixth, seventh, and eighth grade, and then you go on. So that transition to junior high is not as abrupt as it was before, because now they have three or four transitions throughout their college career.
Sure.
I think it was probably better just to have a couple, but now they have a number of them. Every time they change a building.
There is a difference, though. In elementary school, you generally stay in one room with one teacher, or maybe two. And then you go on in junior high to a series of teachers, a series of different rooms. You no longer have your own desk. So those are meaningful things to kids that look to the environment to provide their security.
Well, every one of us really wants to get into a routine. You know, we like mm-hmm. to get some sense of comfort. You want to at some point have your own things, like we talked about before, a transitional object. You want to have your own home, your own car, keep your own car a certain way. You have your own clothes, things like that. And it really starts when we decide that I would like to have some kind of control over my own environment. And when you're in school, and when you're in an office. Sometimes you can have difficulty trying to create your own environment in that macro environment. Certainly you don't want to, as working in a business, you don't want to have a whole lot of transitional objects like you see some people in their cubicle or on their desk, because that may interfere with their ability to function at work. At the same time, at school, you really can't bring in too many things at all, because the school, the teacher is kind of in control about that. But it's important to understand that transitions happen to children irrespective of their readiness for them. And we should probably talk a little bit about how it's difficult for some kids to make a transition because of some, what I will call, developmental delays they have. These are not problems, but these are just lags in maturity. And unless you have difficulty with something with ADHD or with obsessive compulsive disorder or underlying disorders, some kids are slow to warm up. Some kids, like a lot of ADHD, may have a subtype disorder that makes transitions difficult. And people really have to understand that not every child is going to meet the same kind of challenge the same kind of way. And one of the mistakes I think we make fundamentally in education is we try and teach all the kids as though they're the same kind of person. And, of course, teachers know you can't do that. And school systems theoretically know you can't do that, but they still try and do it, because to teach 27 different kids 27 different ways would be impossible. So we should have an idea of being very aware of the difficulty some kids have, not only because of the transition, but because of their own individuality and their difficulty in meeting the transitions, which could be over and above routine garden variety difficulty in transitions.
No, I'm glad you mentioned some psychiatric disorders or childhood psychiatric disorders, ADD, ADHD, and obsessive compulsive disorder, for instance. Transitions are the precipitants of symptoms in these conditions. Mm-hmm. Whereas previously, say, a kid with ADD or ADHD might have done well in elementary school, but the confusion and the changes that are involved in junior high school and then in high school and then in college, mm-hmm. There are significant changes that have to be where the executive function of the child has to be developed and relied upon. They fall down, and that's when they become clinically evident. Certainly, obsessive compulsive disorder is an example of a brain disorder where changes are abhorrent. Mm-hmm. And that's the way the kids are wired. So transitions are very challenging, and that's when you start to see the symptoms coming out.
Right. It's extremely important to understand that what Mark is talking about, so-called psychiatric disorders or behavioral conditions, they really interact with the environment.
Right.
So
mm-hmm.
if you're on a farm, it's really hard to find someone who have ADHD on a farm.
That's right.
Or in an undeveloped country. Hard to find someone. But as soon as you take that person and put them in a very extreme environment where you have to do things in sequence and get your marching orders, it's very difficult to do that. So it's important to understand that there's an environmental interaction, and that's why people talk about what they call the goodness of fit model. Mm-hmm. It's very important to be sure that your child has a good fit with the environment that they're going into, and this could be a classroom, this could be a teacher. It's the most normal thing in the world to think about that. We run into difficulty into America because many principals, many superintendents, many school systems, they would rather fight tooth and nail than to have a child change from teacher A to teacher B, because perhaps they think it's some kind of reflection on the teacher. It's not a reflection on the teacher or the child. You want to put children where they can do the best, and trying to squeeze the proverbial round peg into the square hole is just not going to work. So the goodness of fit really has to be the interaction with the environment and the child's basic abilities.
Mm. Right.
Yeah. There was an interesting statistic. There's a significant rise in the number of psychosomatic symptoms children complain about in the summer between sixth grade and junior high, like headaches and upset stomachs.
Why do you think that could be?
Yeah, you know, like, right. Because I think, wow, I'm going into junior high, and am I going to be able to do the work? And am I going to have, my friends might be going to a different school, and there's a lot going on. That's a tough summer for those kids.
Sure. That's a loss of peer group, and that is critical.
Yeah.
But also at the same time, we talk about transitions in the environment. Kids' bodies are going through transitions as well. And there may be transitions in their lives if grandparents are getting ill, or if parents have lost their job, or if they have to move. Then in addition to their kids going, their friends going into a different building or moving away, there may be huge transitions. And on top of that, their body's changing. And on top of that, they're going into a new building. And they don't know if they're going to be liked or not. So if we can, we can try and help kids to see this, use a coping skill, seeing it as an opportunity, because it's really an opportunity for them to be able to kind of start fresh again. So if they may be trapped in the same classroom with the same cohort for the first 2 or 3 or 4 years, there's a certain comfort level. People know everyone there. But at the same time, you may want to break out of that. And as we all know, when trying to change anything, the people who have known you the longest are the people who are most reluctant to see any changes in you. They're going to, you know, it's like you see a relative you haven't seen for 15 years, they'll still think of you 15 years ago.
Of course,
not
yeah.
So it's sometimes helpful to let kids know it's a real good opportunity to try different things and be not shackled by the way they were before.
That's right.
Yeah, a developmental psychologist at Purdue studied that transition between sixth grade and junior high and found that the students who were doing the least well socially and academically looked forward to junior high the most.
Right.
Starting over, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
In fact, we just mentioned something. There was a study out a few months ago that indicated that people generally who do really well, specifically in junior high school, they're the popular kids, they're the cool kids. Yeah. Following a cohort 20 years later, the researcher found that those kids do substantially worse in life in their 20s and 30s. You would think they might be the golden children and they'll go on forever. They had a lot of difficulty with transitions because they were able to rule the junior high school. But as life gets more complicated, they did not have the skill set. Because they were so popular, they never had the adversity that kind of forced them into coming up with coping skills to deal with adversity. Mm-hmm. So they were hit with adversity at a very difficult time in their life, just finishing college and getting a job, when they really needed some of those skills and they weren't able to develop it because everything came easy to them in junior high school.
Right.
We are talking about the psychology of transitions. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk about going off to college after a break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the psychology of transitions with psychologist Michael Abbruzzese and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, going off to college, this for many kids is the first time they're going away from home. They might have went to camp or something or grandma's and grandpa's for a week, but I mean, this is their first step out on their own.
Right, and reality does not quite meet the expectations of most kids going to college for a couple of things. People tend to look at their child going off to college, and the student also looks at themselves going off to college as perhaps being a good adventure involving just them. But it's really not. It's a family transition. And it's very important to understand that in any major transition, whether it's going off to college, going through a divorce, any kind of medical procedure that you might be having with a major diagnosis, I really recommend strongly people have a transition team in place. I mean, you should have a family therapist, a clinical psychologist. If you know you have an underlying condition that needs medication, you need to have someone on board that's helping prescribe medication. You need to have a whole package in place before this child goes to school. And one of the transition plans should be what happens if something goes wrong in college. And a number of things can go wrong in college, starting with, as we talked about before, just a bad goodness of fit. You can have a college that is great on paper, wonderful name, good Ivy League school, but it's just not the place for you. And a year has not gone by when I've not got 3 or 4 students who have to leave college during the first year, at the end of the first year, because of just some bad things have happened. They've gotten depressed, they've gotten anxious, they've gotten overwhelmed. The college administration seemed cruel and callous to them. They were so upset and stressed they turned to drinking or alcohol. They fell in with the wrong crowd, and they're the ones who got caught when their friends got out and didn't get caught at all. And it's just been a disaster for them and their family. So it's really important to have a transition team in place so in case anything bizarre like that does happen, you can deal with it and the child is not going to lose that year. And it's important also to understand this would be difficult to do because most colleges want parents to butt out. They don't want parents to do anything.
So true,
they ridicule them and demean them by calling them helicopter parents, and they just say, just go away. And when you call and ask how your parents are doing, what do they tell you? Oh, we can't tell you anything because, you know, your child is over 18, you know.
Right.
I'll give you a tip what parents can do. You make sure your child signs a payment statement giving you the ability to talk to the college. It's a very limited power of attorney, essentially, that you can talk to the college about the particular things that you and your child agree to. And the college has to honor that and ask yourself the question. If your family lawyer called the college, do you think the college wouldn't talk to your family lawyer about something? No, they'd have to talk to the family lawyer because the lawyer would have a power of attorney to do that. So make sure that you have a transition in place and make sure that you're able to speak to the college, and don't listen to any kind of college that tries to just essentially say, give us your money, give us your child, and, oh, by the way, don't bother to pick us, don't bother to come and talk to us unless we call you and say you have to take a kid home from college because of an episode and now they're expelled.
Yeah.
College really is a huge transition. One way of looking at the hugeness of it is in terms of mental disorders. That's the time when schizophrenia appears. Mm-hmm. The child can negotiate the structure of high school and the closeness of family environment at that time. But then when they go to college, everything's on their own. And that's a lot of stimulation to take in and organize. And if you have a brain that's vulnerable to disorganization when overwhelmed, which happens with the schizophrenic brain that comes up, that's when you get the disease. And that's commonly what we see is clinicians in the mental health centers at colleges are very keen to this and see this develop all the time.
Yeah. Quite often, historically, you would say the first psychotic break would happen around 18 or 19
that's
years
right.
old.
Yeah.
It's important to understand that some of the college counseling centers are quite good. They've got quite skilled people, but some are not good. But colleges are a hotbed of psychological distress and disorder, and that's something you should understand going in.
Right.
Kathy is giving us a call from Sandwich. Good morning, Kathy.
Yes, hi, good morning. I appreciate the valuable insight.
Sure. My
question is, this is in regard to a transition object. Do you find a difference between young men and young women for either the need or the willingness to take a transition object when they go to college?
I would think so.
Is there a difference between men and women?
I would think so. I think the girls are much more prone to do so openly, and it's almost like romanticized and valued for them to have their stuffed animal with them. Boys,
sure.
Not
yeah.
so. I can't think of what they would be likely to be attached to take.
Yeah. Well, any boy that is going to go to college and wants to have a transitional object, they have more manly things. They've
right.
got baseball cards.
Yeah.
They've got maybe a Cub Scout ring. They've got something that a grandparent gave them, a picture or something. They'll have like one or two kinds of things that maybe a potential girlfriend may find and say, oh, that's interesting. You know, what's the story behind that? Right. But certainly they're not going to have something as obvious as a stuffed animal. But
sure,
the boys
sure.
will find that as quaint and lovely that a girl might have it on her bed, a stuffed unicorn toy or something like that. So boys tend to go to more individual things, one or two items, and they're more for historical accuracy. Oh, my grandfather had that
right.
he got that when he was a child, and he passed it down to my dad. So that's the kind of transitional object they have.
A little bit more private.
Yeah. Kathy, thanks for the question. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. What about students going to college from more isolated communities like Nantucket or Provincetown?
Well, when I was on Nantucket, we had this a lot that it was very isolated back in those days. Now it's not quite so isolated. You get the fast ferry. People can get on and off much more easily. But back then, going to college was a huge transition because you hardly left the island anyway, even on field trip, because it was just so difficult to get off. And then once you went to college, it was very difficult to get back. You couldn't come back every weekend. You couldn't come back hardly every month. It was just too laborious. So it was very difficult. It was quite a culture shock. And so in addition to the geographic distance, it's also a culture shock of living on the island, which essentially you could know everyone who lived there back in the old days. You could do that. And you really can't know everyone unless you go to a small college, and it takes you a while to do that. So you're going to a place where pretty much everyone knows you to a place where nobody knows you and nobody really cares about you because they're too self-absorbed trying to figure out what's going on themselves. And so that is less true for people on Cape Cod, because some people can go over the bridge, and they do quite often, but some other people, some families, grandparents, they just never left the Cape.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes the child going to college could be the first generation routinely going off the Cape for a very long time. Prior to that, it would have been military experience, you know, people going off the Cape for the very first time. We should probably talk about the transition from being a civilian going into military.
And vice versa.
That's right. And this is what they call involuntary separation from the service of people who loved it. You know,
right.
With the downsizing, they get rid of the people who served so well. transitions can be extremely difficult because as a society, we've not yet recognized the importance of making transition assistance available to everyone going through a major life change. We do have some people who get food stamps. We get some people who get EBT cards, and we understand transitions of people who are very poor and have family calamities and stuff. But we don't take equal care to people who are, for example, leaving the military, people who have lost their jobs. And we really need to do that because it's the same kind of stress they experience as someone from Nantucket or perhaps Provincetown going into college for the first time. To go from lots of supports of a small community to absolutely zero supports in a bigger town.
Yeah. Right. And so that brings up another thought. As you're choosing, you know, your child is looking at colleges that they may want to go to, and perhaps you have a child who isn't all that mature yet. Maybe you want to think about smaller colleges rather than the bigger colleges. I mean, is that something that that transition team would be looking at?
Yeah, you want to look at that. That's the goodness of fit. That's the goodness fit model. And sometimes you think that students are famous for this. Well, the parents and the grandparents are thinking, oh, you go from Cape Cod, maybe to a nice school like Boston College or BU. And the students say, are you kidding? I'm going to California. Okay. I'm never seeing you folks again. I'm getting as far away from here as I can. You know, and then they go. And that could be good because initially it's a sense of freedom. There's a sense of new beginning. Sometimes the students can handle that very well. They love to just begin something anew. But there are some people that they don't like new beginnings. They do much better in the routine, you know, and they can't manufacture something for themselves. So it may be all bright and shiny when you get there. And when you get there after a few months, you realize that this is just not working for me. And then you've got to summon the courage to tell your family, I don't think I want to continue here anymore. Mm-hmm. Maybe they say, yeah, I just want to drop out of college because the experience has been so bad. They're not thinking that another college could be a better match for them and fulfilling. Mm-hmm. They're thinking, this is horrible. I can't stand college. Well, it's not, right. College.
Not college.
It's just that particular, you know, placement that you had there.
Yeah.
So then they have the double whammy of the gone someplace that they were looking forward to. It turns out to be dreadful. And I've got to tell my parents I don't want to go to, you know, Berkeley, or even worse, I want to drop out of medical school. I don't want to go to law school anymore. Right. And the parents are, what?
Right.
I've spent all that money.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
One of the things, too, is as a freshman, as you're saying, get into these college campuses. You don't know a lot of people. You're worried about the, you know, workload and all of that. And so then you have that tendency to kind of think, I miss my old friends. The security of mom and dad, you know, right there if I need them. So many freshmen do go through a period of loneliness.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's understandable. Mm-hmm. It's a grief period. And until they can invest sufficiently psychologically into where they are now, there's a sense of loss. And it's to be expected and accepted and not criticized or be judgmental about as if they're weak or wussy or something. Mm-hmm. It simply goes with the territory. It's part of maturing.
Yeah.
It's important to understand, we had a show before, we talked about attachment. Well, part of attachment is attachment and loss, because attachment is a series of reattachments. Attachment is the ability to form attachments, and many people look upon difficulties and transitions as not so much the ability to form reattachments, but as a disability, not be able to deal with the loss, and that's simply not the case. So it's really a matter of what some of the economists like to call creative destruction. Some things end, new things begin. That's seen very commonly in stories about business. A new store comes in, puts the old store out of business. We had book superstores that were supposed to put the old bookstores out of business, and now some book superstores are going out of business. And now you have the rise of the malls, which took the place of businesses on Main Street. Now you've got the internet taking the place of some of the big businesses, and economists like to call that creative destruction, because out of that disaster comes something else that can be built. But you have to realize that you have the fortitude and the ability to build something from it, and that's where a transition team of mentors comes in. Any businessman knows that you need to have a mentor group. If you're in any kind of graduate school, you have a supervisor, you have a mentor. If you're going on for a doctorate, you have people who are the supervisor of your doctoral committee. You have some kind of guidance. And that's really what a transition group is going to be all about. You want to have someone who can give you some kind of guidance and a number of people from different perspectives. And this transition group will follow you throughout your career. The people will change. Some people will leave the group. Other people will be added as different strengths and weaknesses are determined. But you have to realize that Life is a series of transitions and changes, and we all have the ability to cope with them to a greater or lesser extent, and we should find people that can help us do that. And then it's just a series of recreating things.
Sure. And the more skills you develop in transitions, the happier, fuller life you're going to experience.
Right. And it's important to get some of those earlier on distributed fairly evenly throughout your life. If you only wait until late in life, like we during the downturn of 2007, 2008, a lot of people lost their jobs. They really had no life skills about getting new jobs and recreating their lives because their lives have gone pretty well for 20, 30 years.
Right.
If you go 20, 30 years without any kind of adversity, then it's really a huge learning curve, and you really slam the wall and hit it hard. Mm-hmm. And then you're really dealing with a lot of anxiety and depression.
Sure.
Yeah. And, of course, this you talked about this being a family transition. It's not just for the student. And, of course, a lot of parents that, you know, maybe their only child or their youngest now and they've got the empty nest and there's that transition, the parents and the grandparents and whatever other family mm-hmm. members you have around. And you were mentioning the military and you think that transition, too. You know, parents, of course, you're worried about your child going off to college and you think, oh, my gosh, all these things that could or may happen or may not happen. And same thing with them when your child's going up in the military, you worry about, you know, their safety.
Absolutely, especially in the past 10, 15 years.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, it's one thing that you mentioned the military. People are really concerned about safety when kids go to the military for a lot of different reasons that are pretty obvious. You can be killed, you can be maimed. People tend to not have that kind of concern about their kids going to college. People have the image of college being a fairly kind of safe place, but they don't worry about their kids getting killed or maimed. And I guess I'm slowly moving into the camp where I think that you should consider that a real possibility because you can be psychologically scarred in college. We've had stories out for the past couple of years about how colleges don't seem to respond to sexual abuse and rape allegations or investigations as much as they should. So going to college, I think, is maybe not as anxiety-provoking as a child going into the military, but I think it has to be considered by parents be right up there. So you should prepare.
Sure.
Yeah. Michael from Martha's Vineyard called to express his appreciation of our discussion. He says the, quote, compelling talk and generous treatment of this subject has prompted him to muse on adjunct topics from his own personal history. Michael, thanks for that. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number if you'd like to join the conversation. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. More after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the psychology of transitions with psychologist Michael Abbruzzese and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, let's talk a little bit about nostalgia and how that the role it has in helping us with transitions.
Yeah, we haven't really mentioned that specifically. But, you know, earlier on in our history, nostalgia was looked at almost as a mental illness. It was called immigrant psychosis, was one of the terms. In other words, when an immigrant comes to the country, they're very disoriented, and they start nostalgizing, if I said that right, about the old world. It was looked down upon. But there has been some research, and it has shown just how useful being nostalgic is and how it helps us, soothes us, and is actually attached to some physiological changes that are positive, which is really fascinating to me, which says that nostalgia is a exercise that enhances survival, if you look at it from the evolutionary standpoint, because it helps us physiologically adjust to something that's new and disrupting. The study specifically had to do with several different studies, but one of them, for instance, had to do with how nostalgia makes you feel warm. Actually feel warm and can change body temperature a bit. In China and universities there, they found that people that were in cold rooms below, say, 68 degrees tended to engage in nostalgia, where people in warm rooms didn't as much. Interesting change. Then they've also done laboratory manipulations where they induce a negative mood and see how people start to engage in nostalgia more than people who are not induced into a negative mood.
We have a classic nostalgic moment from the movies.
If that plane leaves the ground and you're not with him, you'll regret it. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but soon and for the rest of your life.
But what about us?
We'll always have Paris.
There it is. We'll always have Paris. Casablanca, of course.
Can't be said any better. That's nostalgia at its core.
What about music? There's been some... I mean, music really brings you... Think about when you were in high school and a song comes on the radio now. It just brings you right back there.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you feel generally positive, although it can bring you back to some negative memories.
That breakup in, you know, seventh grade.
That's right.
Well, there's nothing that makes us feel good that at some point cannot also make us feel bad.
Sure.
If you're in a pretty good mood, nostalgia is great, but if you're not in such a great mood, then those aren't nostalgic thoughts. Those are regrets.
You know? Sometimes. So you but the really nostalgic thoughts can heal the regrets, because that's what the stories of nostalgia tend to be. They tend to be ones of generally triumph. It starts out bad, but there is some sense of triumph or healing, rising above it. That's soothing.
It really is. It really is soothing. And we have to understand that nostalgia can have a very healing process. In fact, there was even a song, as I recall, from the 70s by Elton John. And one of the lines in the song was, sad songs say so much.
Mm-hmm.
Because it really can be very uplifting. And so what could be depressing to someone else when they hear maybe a grandparent or an older parent reminiscing, they may think, oh boy, I guess they must really be depressed because they're remembering the old days, when in reality they're not having a bad time at all. They're actually having quite a good time in reminiscing.
Sure.
Oh, yeah. It could be the opposite. I had a friend, I remember her mom said, oh, you two go ahead. I'm just going to stay home and listen to my Frank Sinatra records. Yeah. That was key for, I'm going to just be here lonely by myself.
Hidden message.
Hidden message, exactly. So let's talk about some other transitions. Becoming a parent is another, getting married, becoming a parent, but especially becoming a parent, because it's exciting, but it's also pretty scary, especially that first when you're thinking, wow, can I do this? I have this little human being that I'm going to be responsible for.
Well, I think that it's a couple of different things involved in that. Some people aren't scared until after the child is born when they realize, oh, my God, how much work is this? I never realized that.
Right. And I'm other not going to sleep for a long time.
I don't think people ever realize that. You know, they keep having this hope, this fantasy that they are going to get sleep tonight, and they're not sure when that's going to end. And, of course, when you have a child who may be, for example, colicky or maybe what some of the theorists called a difficult child or a slow-to-warm-up child. Again, there's nothing wrong with the parenting. There's nothing wrong with the child. It's simply that it wasn't a very good match. You have a child with a different temperament, and they're born somewhat different in their regularity, their rhythmicity of systems management than the parent is. So a child may just be on a different body clock than you are.
Sure.
And when that starts to sink in, it quite often makes the parents think that they're doing something wrong. They've done something wrong. They parented badly, and they think, oh, my God, it's only been 2 weeks. What could I have done wrong? And so they start to feel very bad, and that could be a self-fulfilling prophecy because you don't want to start feeling bad about your parenting skills and think you have a lack of parenting skills, and that's going to make you be less likely to want to parent your child when they're very young, and that's going to disrupt their child's ability to form healthy attachments, and that's going to disrupt the child's life for a very long time to come. So it's important to understand that you don't have to be a super parent. You can be overwhelmed and still be a great parent, and you just have to be a parent that does the best that they can in what they call the goodness of fit model, a good enough parent, what some theorists call. So it's important to understand that even though it's stressful, that you can be a good parent and you can get the kind of help you need for coaching if you need some help in that.
And I think that all the negative things that come out, that cascade of negative events that you just described, part of it is fed a lot by the guilt people have about how negative they feel about the experience of parenthood, which goes with the territory. It simply is a very difficult transition to be caring 100% for another human being and be so responsible. And there has been studies about it. It simply makes sense. Parents... there was a 2010 article in the Journal of Medical Association journal that among new parents, 3 to 6 months after birth, 42% of the mothers and 26% of the fathers exhibited signs of depression, clinical depression, so meaningful depression. There's such a big change there. Men on average increased have increased depressive symptoms during the first 5 years of being a parent. Now, that's only if the man was living in the household and being an active parent. If he was out, he wasn't subject so much to this increase in depression. So it wears on people. And one of the, I think, feeders for depression is this guilt about you shouldn't feel this way. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't be so distressed about this, when in fact it simply is a very, very distressing experience and should be accepted as such, as opposed to judged bad. Mm-hmm. Because once you get into the judged bad realm, then you're feeding the negativity and actually making things worse for yourself and the child.
Yeah. Well, that's true. It's important to understand that just because it's a lot of stress, we talk about women going through postpartum depression. We have new research indicate that men go through what they call postpartum depression, what Mark is just talking about. And that is part and parcel. I guess an example might be from going 60 miles an hour in a car to slamming the brakes on, because your life changes so dramatically. Right. When that little person comes home, it's a totally different life for you, and you have no preparation. You have no clue. No matter how much your friends tell you things are going to change, you don't really understand it.
You
don't believe it. And so it's very normal to go through this transitional phase, and it's very important to monitor yourself, as we talked at the beginning of the show, monitor yourself for any kind of negative emotions you may have, and see what kind of role they may play in perpetuating this, because it's very common to go through a very stressful situation of caregiving.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely.
And if you're a single parent,
that's even tougher.
And a lot of moms are single parents because, based on what Mark said, you can understand why. Dads love to go to the office. Why do you think dads disappear so much? They're getting out of there while the getting's good, and they've got to come home. And it's very difficult.
It's been shown that people find parenting more fatiguing than work.
Yeah,
That's for sure. And before we scare any of those people away who are thinking, should I have there's a lot of rewards. Certainly it's a tough job, but it's a very rewarding job as well. So let's talk a little about transitioning between parents in a divorced family.
Well, a divorce is like a bomb going off in the family. In some cases, it's like a nuclear bomb going off. It just destroys everything, grandparents and all of that stuff. So it's really important. I always recommend people have a transition team. Many people think you just need to get a lawyer and hope for the best. Well, in Massachusetts, there are a set of rules and guidelines. So pretty much any lawyer has a lot of experience can be able to tell you pretty much how things are going to sort out. And if you get a lawyer who's able to do that for you, then that really will minimize a lot of your anxiety. But still, you don't know the emotional twists and turns that it may take, and you don't know who the opposing counsel might be. Nowadays, because lawyers are so expensive, many people are choosing to go through mediation, or they're not going in with any lawyer. Only one of them has a lawyer. And that's divorce is one of those conditions where you probably can try and navigate some of it on your own with just a little bit of help here and there in terms of the legal system. But try to go through mediation, try and minimize the stress of the transitions. And again, you need a transition team in place. I strongly recommend you have an experienced therapist, psychologist, psychiatrist, social worker, someone who has a lot of experience dealing with the court system and divorces, to help pinpoint areas that might need improvement and maybe identify when a child may need to check in with someone. They don't always have to, but sometimes they do. And also how to assist in a co-parenting plan. And that may have to be a person like that may have to be on board for several years, because sometimes the hurt lingers on for 2 or 3 or 4 years after a divorce.
Mm. Right. Yeah. The analogy of a bomb hitting a family is very accurate. And it's very challenging on the parent because they're hurting themselves or they're angry seeking revenge or all sorts of emotional agendas. And the child also has their emotional agenda, too. And it's hard to get out of your own when you're feeling so strongly. But you need to. And you need to appreciate what the child is coming from and going through. So simple pieces of advice. Don't talk about how you're going to miss the child when there's an impending several-week visit.
No, that would be bad.
That doesn't make sense, because then the child's worried about how
right.
you're feeling.
Right.
And don't pump the child for information.
That's really
in
important.
Return.
Yeah, and sometimes people do that inadvertently.
Yeah.
When you come home from school, you say, well, how was your day at school? When you come home from visitation with the other parent, sometimes very normal, say, so how did everything go?
Mm-hmm.
Very innocent,
right.
Like you could care less. But sometimes the kids think that they're put in the middle.
Right. Yeah.
And sometimes
right.
it's not so innocent. Sometimes parents want to, co-parent want to know everything.
Yeah.
But it's important to understand that you have to try and minimize the stress on the child.
Right. Yeah,
and if the kids of parents with the most hostility between them are going to have the most trouble adjusting because there's that loyalty conflict.
That's right.
And you may not be intentionally trying to put your child in the middle, but the child feels in the, you know, it's like, right. They already feel that to begin with.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. So understandable that transitions can be scary and make you a tad anxious, a new job, a new school, living in a new city or town. Maybe you're moving on to an assisted living facility, whatever the transition is. You want to think opportunity, right? I mean, that's how you get through some of these is instead of looking at what you're losing, try to look at the opportunities of what you can gain.
Well, that would be a good coping skill. But most people, when they're first slammed by a surprise, they really can't think like that. So when Mark was talking before about how you try and deal with making the right decisions in a divorce, you know, it's very difficult to do that. It's very difficult to make the correct decisions because you're in the middle of something that you really don't know. It's like you're drowning and you're trying to help yourself without anyone else helping you. The same thing when you first get a severe medical diagnosis, you may be so shell-shocked that you can't make the really right decision. Try to avoid making major life decisions when you're in the middle of a depression or when you have post-traumatic stress disorder, which can be caused by a divorce or a major medical diagnosis. But, of course, those are the times that people are demanding we make major life decisions right away.
Yeah. Right.
So it's very difficult to do. So you do have to be careful about making major life decisions when you're so slammed by emotions because you don't know what the right decision will be. And once you have more a grasp of your own emotional life, then you'll be able to make a different decision. You may change your mind. So going back to the divorce thing for a second, it's helpful to say things like to the child, like, no matter what happens, understand that you'll always have a mom and dad who cares about you and loves you. You mm-hmm. want to say things like, I'm going to do the very best I can, and I'm not going to let you down. Mm-hmm. You want to say things as supportive as you can, taking into consideration that you don't always know the exact outcome of things. But understand that what you can do is try to control and regulate your reaction to a major life trauma, such as a major medical diagnosis, going into a nursing home, or even going to a rehab center from the hospital, or going through a divorce. But it's really hard to be able to do that, and that's why you need a transition team, someone to be able to point out some things that you may not yourself see, like a basketball player needs a basketball coach, even if that person can't play basketball. The person coaching you can see, well, how come your elbow is out that way? Well, it looks like you're not aiming for the basket. Anyone can look in from the outside and they can maybe perform a helpful function, but you need to understand you can't go through any of these things, any major life transition alone. It's just not a wise choice.
Right. Yeah, it reminds me, one of the major life transitions is just the one of getting older.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly experience that at my age. And also my patients. A lot of people that I see are having trouble, understandably, adjusting to their bodies being quite different and not reliable anymore, so that their sense of themselves is assaulted, if you will, and very much damaged. And that produces some psychiatric symptoms. So that's another challenge to be able to cope with the inevitable change that we have as we do get older, if we're lucky to get older, because mm-hmm. Not everybody is. And the change, for instance, of going into a nursing home, giving up driving, giving up mm-hmm. All those kind of things, it all adds up to the ultimate transition is the one when we take our last breath and leave this life, which is terrifying to so many people. But if you can look at it in terms of the long run of transitions, maybe you can see it a little bit less toxic, a little bit less frightening.
And it's important to understand that some people see the changes in their body as a betrayal.
Yes.
An internal betrayal, not just, oh, well, I can't run as fast. They actually see the body as being a betrayal of them.
An enemy.
Yep. Psychologist Michael Abbruzzese and psychiatrist Mark Whaley, as always, thank you for being here.
Thank you very much.
I'm Indy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of WCAI, the local NPR station for the Cape, the Coast, and the Islands.